Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. How far back can you trace your individual family tree? Most of us have to stop at 3 or 4 generations unless we've got a relative who's into genealogy. Collectively, though, we humans have amassed a pretty extraordinary record of our distant ancestors, people whose stories we can only guess at through the clues left by their remains, but whose very existence demonstrates that who we are today is not always who we've been. Not surprisingly, then, we've turned some of our most significant fossil finds into celebrities of a sort. The bony image of Lucy can be found in memes and on tote bags. Epic poems have been written about the Tong Child, and casts of Peking Man were shipped to labs all over the world. As my guests will tell us, each has advanced our understanding of our own evolution, but also offers clues to the state of contemporary culture. The new book by author Lydia Pine is called Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. Lydia, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So the fossils we'll talk about today are important for what they can tell us about evolution, but you note that scientific significance is not necessarily a guarantee that a fossil will be well known. There are some important fossils that are pretty obscure and some celebrities that may not be the best of their specimen.
No, absolutely. And your point that these are things, these are fossils that are made into celebrities and they sort of have this life apart from their science is very much at the heart of what I wanted to write about with Seven Skeletons.
What made you start thinking about this?
That's a really good question. Sort of where do you come up with an idea like Seven Skeletons as a book? And it actually is at that very thing we were talking about, that there are these scientific stories that go with fossils and that there are these cultural stories that go with the fossils. And I was really interested in the idea that a person could write the biography of an object, that they could look at the history of an object and combine both the science and the cultural stories together and to look at these fossils as more than just an important scientific discovery or an important piece of evidence in scientific debates along its various points in history. But it could also have this kind of cultural life, that these could be fossils that we know and that we think about, whether or not we consciously know that we know them or not.
So it's not so different maybe from why one artist is world famous and another with the same level of technical proficiency labors in obscurity. The story is part of the value.
Oh, I think that that's absolutely true. And I think that the story of these fossil celebrity is very contingent, that it very much depends on the context that these fossils are discovered in, what debates are important in science when they're discovered, who discovers them, who's able to sort of market the fossils, who's able to sort of rally media to sort of be interested in the fossils. They also, of course, have to have this kind of scientific import, but they also have to be available to the public, to be able to be known.
So the old man of La Chapelle became this kind of Neanderthal mascot. Tell us how those bones were found in the mid-19th century.
So the old man of La Chapelle, I think, is one of my favorite Neanderthals and was definitely, I know, I have favorite Neanderthals, and was definitely one of the first fossils that I started writing about with this project. So the old man of La Chapelle was discovered in France in 1909. Other Neanderthal specimens had been discovered well before the old man. In 1856, the first fossil is found actually in the Neander Valley in Germany. And when that fossil was finally designated as its own taxa, its own Homo neanderthalensis, its own species, other specimens from different museums that had been collected are sort of folded into the Neanderthal story, that scientists looked at these other fossils and said, hey, wait, this actually looks an awful lot like these other Neanderthals. So by 1909, there are several specimens, several Neanderthals that are known to the scientific world. But in 1909, two French abbeys are actually charged with, they're prehistorians, and they're charged with going out in the French countryside, the south central part of France, and to conduct an archaeological survey of the region to see what kind of prehistoric remains, what kind of prehistoric material culture, all of these sorts of things could be found. And so the abbés, Amédée and Jean Bousinet, go out and start their excavations. And in August of 1909, they actually come across this really exciting find. They're excavating a cave in the town of La Chapelle. And they come across this skeleton that's in the floor of the cave. And the skeleton is flexed. It's buried. It has all of this sort of interesting cultural context that this could be a burial. The Bousinet brothers see it and they say, wow, this is a really interesting discovery. But we're trained as prehistorians. We're not trained as anatomists. So they send the fossil to an anatomy expert in Paris, Marisan Boulay. And Boulay takes this specimen and spends 2 years studying it. And in 1911, publishes this massive monograph about the skeleton. And from that monograph that really became the foundation for a lot of 20th century Neanderthal studies, Boulay offers this interpretation that based on Boulay's study of the skeleton, the Neanderthal is hunched and it's very primitive looking. And Boulay sort of offers these other observations that Neanderthals couldn't have complex culture. And there's a lot about how Neanderthals, I think, became internalized in popular culture that can be traced back to Boulay's original work with that. And so scientists today who are working with Neanderthals are very much trying to counter that narrative that Boulay puts out in the beginning of the 20th century and find ways to sort of introduce viewers and introduce people and audiences to the idea that Neanderthals are a lot more complicated than scientists originally thought over 100 years ago.
It's just such an interesting time because, so we had this probably incorrect idea that Neanderthals were our dumb caveman cousins, right? But you're not.
Right,
you're
that not, it's this meme almost.
Yeah, but you're not so far removed from the time when serious scientists were still trying to square natural history with biblical accounts of creation.
Certainly, you see that in the sort of mid-19th century and the late 19th century, and it becomes this sort of really tricky question of sort of what do we make of Neanderthals? We've put them as this other species. We've sort of designated them as not part of us as Homo sapiens. We've given them sort of an offshoot branch in their family tree, in the sort of human family tree. And I think that for a lot of the 20th century, the idea was that this is a failed species. This is the species that couldn't make it. And it almost takes on this sort of moral rhetoric of this is Homo sapiens' superiority to be able to successfully evolve in the Pleistocene. And I think, again, that this is a lot of sort of what 21st century Neanderthal studies are working to counter, these preconceptions like that.
I love that you put the story of Piltdown Man in this book because this one gets a little asterisk next to it.
It does. It does. And I think that initially there's a little bit of pushback of, wait a minute, this isn't actually a fossil. Why is it here in the story of famous fossils? But I think that for 40 years, that for so much of this fake's life, this fake fossil's life, it was a fossil. And I think that carries an incredible amount of cachet in how we think about the making of celebrity scientific discoveries.
So, Lydia, for people less nerdy than you and me who are saying, what are you two talking about, Piltdown
right,
Man?
Right.
Tell us the story about how he was introduced to the world by Charles Dawson.
Sure. In 1912, Charles Dawson, who is an amateur naturalist, he's also a solicitor in Sussex, and are in Piltdown in Sussex. And he has been collecting specimens. He has been collecting curiosities, curios, antiquities, you name it, he collects it. And he would send a lot of his natural history specimens to the Natural History Museum in London, that he had struck up a correspondence with a very prominent paleontologist and anatomist, Smith Woodward, Arthur Smith Woodward. And so Dawson would send all of these curios and all of these fossil bits to Smith Woodward, and Smith Woodward would add them to the museum's collection. And in 1912, Dawson wrote to Smith Woodward and said, I have found the most amazing discovery here in the gravel sounds in Piltdown. He describes the fossil as being really curious, that it looks a little bit like a modern human. It looks a little bit like Homo. He describes other parts of it looking a little bit different, that it's primitive a little bit, and he describes it as what he would call a missing link, that this is finally going to be Britain's sort of old evidence of early humankind, whereas France had these exciting Neanderthal discoveries, other places in Europe have these really exciting Paleolithic discoveries. Britain at that point didn't have any actual bones, any actual sort of human ancestral bones. And so Dawson has found this fantastic find. And so he writes to Smith Woodward and sort of sings the praises of this specimen. They excavate it, they organize a field season at the Piltdown Manor, they excavate it, they find some other fauna, hippo, and some other sort of mammalian fauna that's associated with it. So it feels like this is a really exciting discovery. And in 1912, so when it had first been excavated and was first discovered, the scientists and Dawson had tried to kind of keep it under wraps until they could get an official publication out. But in December of 1912, the museum announces that it's going to publish this fossil. And the media just queues up. I mean, the room is packed for this announcement that this is a really exciting thing to have this kind of ancestor. And so when it's announced, it just has so much support in the scientific community behind it, particularly in the European scientific circles. There are a few detractors in the early days that say this is kind of an odd looking fossil for a missing link, or this has some very weird looking anatomy. This doesn't quite make sense to me. A lot of those detractors were coming from institutes in the United States, like the Smithsonian Institute. But by and large, Piltdown was accepted as a human ancestor. It was called Eoanthropus Dawsoni, is its scientific name. And for 40 years, it was seen as a great example of a human ancestor. Eventually, it was proven to be a hoax, that it's actually not very old. It's not from the Pleistocene. The bits of the skull are actually from a medieval human, a human that dates to the medieval period, and the jaw was actually part of an orangutan, a modern orangutan. And so when this fossil is debunked, to say this is not a fossil, it's not a fake, it's not a human ancestor, It was and still is the longest perpetrated hoax in the history of science, which I find to be sort of this interesting sort of note to it, that there's this sense that we sort of collectively, we science, culture, sort of everything writ large wants it to be real. And for so many decades it was.
And a lot had to be sort of rewritten in what had become the canon of evolutionary history.
Absolutely. And with the debunking of Piltdown, it really opened up the space, the intellectual space, the scientific space for other discoveries. So another fossil that I write about is the Tong Child that was discovered in South Africa in 1924. But because of fossils like Piltdown, the Tong Child wasn't accepted as a human ancestor until well after the Piltdown Man was debunked. And so it definitely... This fake fossil had this cast this incredible shadow over the field of paleoanthropology and over sort of how people thought human evolution, how scientists thought human evolution worked, and what got to count as a fossil, what got to count as an ancestor. And so when it's debunked, it really has this amazing impact to be able to allow other fossils to take their place.
All right, we'll talk about the Tong Child in a couple of minutes. My guest is author Lydia Pine. We're talking about her new book, Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Lydia Pine. Her new book is called Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Lydia, you said earlier that the Tong Child had been discovered and was known to science, but wasn't really paid much attention to. Its founders' ideas about what this was were ignored. Simply put, the Tong Child was just not what anybody was expecting to find once everybody believed that Piltdown Man was real.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I find really interesting about all of these famous fossils is that they all have these really compelling origin stories, that they all have a great story of the fossil's discovery. And honestly, the story of Raymond Dart discovering the Tong Child is one of my favorites in the book. And so Dart is a professor of anatomy at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. And in 1924, he had sort of put out this call to the local limeworks that he was interested in any kind of curious fossils that they blasted out during their work. So the mine would send Dart these crates of fossils, and this crate arrived in October of 1924, the same day that Dart and his wife are hosting a wedding, and Dart's supposed to serve as the best man. And so this crate of fossils arrives. His wife is totally not impressed with the fact that these fossils have interrupted the wedding festivities, tells Dart, just leave it, just leave the fossils, you know, we'll come back to them tomorrow, it's not a big deal. But Dart just starts, you know, cranks open the crate, starts rummaging through them, and finds these two pieces of the Tong Child fossil. He finds a fossilized brain, and he finds the face of the very small primate hominid. And with these two pieces, he's just sitting there. And in his autobiography, Dart is fantastic. He describes this moment of discovery as imagining himself as to be the instrument in Darwin's hands of bringing the study of human evolution back to Africa. I mean, there's no aiming low for this guy in sort of what kind of import this fossil would have. And then Dart describes the bridegroom, you know, sort of remember the poor guy who's getting married here, sort of starts tugging on his sleeve and saying, you know, we've got a wedding. We've got to get back to the wedding, you know, put the fossils away. And so Dart says that he pockets the fossils and then goes down to the wedding. And sort of wraps up the episode, this fantastic story of discovery with that. Dart spends the next 40 days. He borrows a pair of his wife's knitting needles and sharpens them into small picks and picks the fossil matrix, the extra part of rock that's around a fossil. He chips that off and reveals the three parts of the fossil. So it's the fossilized brain, the face, and then the jaw or the mandible. And 40 days after finally freeing the fossil, he publishes it in Nature in 1925.
What was so special about the Tong Child?
So a couple of things. First of all, it is a child. The hominid was about 3 years old when it died. And so it was one of the very first juvenile fossils to be found. But it was also a really interesting example of a species, Australopithecus africanus, that would be able to walk bipedally. And so Dart is a neuroanatomist. He's used to looking at the brain and the anatomy that has to do with that. And he sees the position of where the spinal cord would have gone for this particular primate and knows, based on his anatomy training, he knows that this particular specimen would have been bipedal. It would have walked on two legs. And he thought, this is a really interesting idea that this early, that we could have an ancestor that's this old and have this small of a brain relative to its age, but it could be bipedal. And at that point, it was very much in vogue in the scientific communities to think that sort of big brains, the sort of trademark characteristic of Homo sapiens, had evolved before bipedality. And so Dart is proposing this different narrative that suddenly we have bipedality before we have big brains. He also is proposing that the origin for this is going to be centered in Africa, where at that point, most of the very, very early research was centered in Southeast Asia, in Java, and then other specimens back in Europe. So he's sort of fighting an uphill battle the entire way with the publication with his fossil.
Once it was out there and the Tong child was accepted, it became, as you say, a kind of folk hero. There were poems written about it, short stories.
Yes, there. And when I went to the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg and started working with DART's archive, all of the materials, the boxes of stuff that DART had accession to the museum, it was amazing to see just how much ephemera there was about this fossil that had surrounded it. As you say, there were poems. There are some truly awful poems, but there was also some hilarious poems. There's one that went on for 12 pages. There are photographs, there are doodles, there are sketches. There was a novella, this sort of short story novella that some ardent fan had written and sent into DART. And it was just, it really spoke to me that there was, that this was a fossil that resonated with popular audiences, that this was a fossil that people loved. And it was really, I think it really struck me that how powerful that was to have this kind of fossil that, that the public and scientific circles could identify with.
We have an email here from Adam in Fort Worth who says, the skeletons in the book were all found in Africa, Europe, and Asia. Have any significant hominin fossils been discovered in the Americas?
No, as a short answer to your question. There are very early settlements in the Americas, but most of those trace back to just Homo sapiens, and most of those trace back to around 20,000 years ago, I think is the date for some of the first settlement of the Americas.
All right, Peking Man, back to Asia here, is most famous for going missing. How was he discovered, and what kind of specimen was he?
Sure. So Peking Man is actually a collection of fossils. It's a collection of individuals, and it was known collectively. It's sort of all of these individuals came together and were collectively known as Peking Man. And they were discovered in the early 20th century at the Peking site, just outside of Peking. And so the site was Zhoukoudian. It's just outside of Peking. And at this point, there was a lot of interest in the 1930s that was beginning to accelerate, a lot of the scientific interest in looking for early humankind in Asia. Again, sort of thinking back, we talked about how there was so much interest in Southeast Asia. At this point, scientific interest starts to shift toward China and Asia proper. And so a lot of Chinese geologists and a lot of Chinese scientists are pairing up with different institutions, European institutions, also American institutions, to start massive excavations at this site called Zhoukoudian. And the site is in the Chinese countryside, and for close to a decade, researchers excavated this site. They moved massive amounts of dirt, massive amounts of fossils. There's one account that talks about loading 80 sort of railway cars worth of fossils. And a lot of them are sent to the Cenozoic Institute that's in Peking. A lot of other fossils are also shipped to the University of Uppsala in Sweden, where a lot of the early interest in excavations for Peking Man, where a lot of the early interest first came from. And so a lot of the museum collections were held there, and a lot were also held, as I said, in Peking at the laboratory there.
So what happened?
So where are these fantastic fossils? And so when World War II set in and the Japanese army invaded Peking, researchers at the lab were really nervous that these fossils would be appropriated, that they would be sort of considered looted, or that something would happen to these fossils. And so they boxed up the fossils and sent them out actually under guard with a team of U.S. Marines, and they disappeared. No one knows exactly where they are. And certainly scientists and historians have spent decades trying to figure out where they are. One account has them sinking in the Yangtze River. Another account has them sort of sold off for money. Other accounts have them have them popping up in various and other sundry places. And certainly in the 1960s and the 1970s, there was a huge push to sort of recover, to find Peking Man. And so there were just countless people that were coming out of the woodwork sort of with their stories of this is what happened to Peking Man. And so far, none of them have panned out. They're still missing.
This story.
So we study Peking. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it makes me think of that scene at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Where the Ark of the Covenant is sort of lost in that colossal warehouse.
Right, right. And so what's interesting to me, though, is that this is still an incredibly important specimen in paleoanthropology. All of the whole collection of Peking Man is important, but we know them through their casts. And this was a really interesting, different kind of celebrity that the copy could be as famous now as the original.
You actually had personal experience, just jumping back here for a minute, with the Tong Child original.
I did, actually. When I was at the University of the Witwatersrand, I had the opportunity to tour through the fossil vault and to see this Tong Child specimen. And it was amazing to spend some one-on-one time with it. But the first time I had met it or had encountered it was when I was an undergraduate on a field school. And was treated to see a fossil demo by the eminent scientist Philip Tobias while he was still alive.
So Lucy has become this truly iconic figure as an early human ancestor. What is her modern day origin story?
So I think it's hard to find a fossil that's more famous than Lucy. And certainly there was no question when I was organizing and thinking about the book and designing it, there was no question that Lucy would feature in the book. So Lucy was discovered in 1974 by a team of American geologists and paleoanthropologists who were working in the Hadar region of Ethiopia. Lucy was found at the end of one of the fields, at the end of the first field season, or excuse me, she was found at the end of the second field season for this particular consortium. And she's sort of immediately brought into the press by her discoverer, Dr. Donald Johansson. I had the opportunity to look through some of the old Ethiopian Herald, so the local newspaper for Addis Ababa, and to track down her first press release, which happens just 2 weeks after her discovery.
It's worth noting that she also has an Ethiopian name, but how did she get the name that we know her by?
Right. So Lucy, so in Johansson's memoir, he writes that Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, the Beatles song, was playing at camp the night she was discovered. And so the team christened her Lucy. And that's actually how she appears in her first press release. So at that point, Lucy doesn't have a scientific name. Scientists haven't studied her to know that she's going to be a new species, Australopithecus afarensis. But as early as that first media interview, she is known as Lucy.
They know she's a woman because they have a fragment of her pelvis?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, so I've seen pictures of Lucy. I find the whole history very interesting. When you see what has been recovered of her, it's impressive, like, on an intellectual level, but the bones themselves don't seem like so much.
It's really interesting to look at the bones. And I had a chance to see Lucy several years ago, actually, when she came on tour to the United States. I had an opportunity to visit her at the Natural History Museum in Houston. And it was amazing to see her laid out in this perfectly articulated anatomical position. I mean, it's sort of that classic, iconic view of Lucy, and to realize just how small she really is. And as you say, just how few bone fragments there are. It's amazing that she's 40% of a complete skeleton. But you look at that and realize, wow, that's 40%. That's not 100%.
What can we tell by studying those bones about what she might have looked like when she walked on Earth?
So one of the big exciting discoveries about Lucy when she was first studied by anthropologists who were interested particularly in locomotion was Lucy was a really great example of looking at exactly how Australopithecus afarensis would have been bipedal. So scientists are able to study her gait, they're able to study how she would have walked, and to look at this kind of species that would have spent some time in the trees, but also a significant amount of time on the ground. And so Lucy was able to answer a lot of really important scientific questions when she was discovered.
And she's become a kind of scientific touchstone. You note in the book that fossils are now sort of oriented before or after we assume that she lived in order to orient those new fossils, orient those who are interested in those fossils as to what time period they lived in and what stage of evolution they were at.
Absolutely. It was interesting to realize, sort of as I started looking through descriptions of new fossils that have come out post-Lucy, almost all of them in press releases, in publications, in just so much media, and were either described as this fossil was before Lucy, this fossil is after Lucy, this fossil walks bipedally, just like Lucy, that it felt very much like Lucy became this touchstone, this character almost that people were familiar with. And so because you know Lucy, it became a way of introducing people, I think, to new and other fossils.
Are there particular climates where fossils or human fossils are more likely to occur simply because of the weather conditions, that sort of thing?
Certainly geology and weather and all of those sorts of things play a huge role in whether or not bones can fossilize. And then sort of at the time that an animal dies, the conditions that the bones are originally in definitely play a huge role. So things like peat moss and bogs and other really wet environments can be really difficult for bones to actually fossilize. Other environments that are drier, that have a lot of, that are calcium carbonate rich, other sorts of geological settings like that are very conducive to bone. And so a lot of the fossils that we find are from these kind of areas that have this kind of really good geology. So like limestone or other sorts of geology like that can be really good examples and for fossil discoveries.
Author Lydia Pine is my guest. We're talking about her new book, Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Lydia Pine about her new book, Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Edward on the line in Dallas. Hey, Edward.
Hey, Chris. Hey, thanks for the show today. So I've got a question. So I was watching a program recently on Ötzi, the guy they found in Switzerland, and the background of how he came to be there. So I just wanted to know if for the fossils that your guest is talking about today, if she has any information on the context of how those human remains were found. Were they isolated? Were they with other beings, with other, you know, bodies? Do they know anything about how that person got to be there or died?
Thanks for your call.
That's a good question, and it's a very cool discovery. That's definitely feel like I end up needing to do like seven more skeletons or something like that. As for details about the discovery, I'll be honest that I'm not as up on that as I probably ought to be. I do know that it was an isolated discovery, and I do know that it's been a fantastic specimen for scientists to go back to year after year as new methods are being figured out, new methods for testing, whether it's looking at the Iceman's tattoos or whether it's looking at isotopes that provide researchers with clues about the Iceman's diet. All of those things sort of strike me as being a really amazing specimen to be able to keep going back to for things like that.
If I understand correctly, Edward was asking actually about the skeletons that you detail in this book. Were any of them, say, found with artifacts or contextual
objects? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, of course. Okay. Now that makes a lot more sense. I see what you're asking. My apologies. So definitely the Old Man of La Chapelle is actually found with other cultural artifacts, stone tools, things like that. But the other specimens, specifically Lucy, some of the older Australopithecines, there are no other cultural artifacts like that. There are some stone tools found in the context with Flo, the hobbit, and the Piltdown forgery. There are some stone tools and a very famous implement that was termed a cricket bat, of all things. Probably it's very British, I guess, in that kind of discovery. That was ultimately decided to ultimately termed to be fake as well. So there are some fake artifacts to go with the Piltdown man and some real artifacts to go with the Neanderthal and the Hobbit.
You mentioned, okay, the Hobbit, that's Flo or Homo floriensis. She arrived at a time when popular culture was thinking a lot about hobbits. This shorthand name to describe her helped solidify our sense of who she was.
Absolutely. And I think that this is one of the most interesting examples of a fossil that sort of has its cultural moment already sort of carved out for it. So when the fossil was discovered and published, in 2004, I think that the entire world was pretty much primed to be thinking about hobbits and small hominins and things like that, thanks in no small part to the Lord of the Rings craze. And so when it is published, the idea that there's this small hominid and calling it a hobbit just sort of immediately catapults this cachet, and it immediately sort of cashes in on the idea that there's this curiosity.
It appears that she lived quite recently compared to many other skeletons, but of course she's very different than the bodies of modern humans or Neanderthals. So why is that such a thrilling detail?
So when Homo floresiensis was first discovered, the date that was published with her was about 18,000 years ago, which is incredibly recent in the fossil record. That's very recent. There was a paper that came out last year, actually, that offered a new date to the fossil that is centered somewhere between 60 and 100,000 years ago. So she's been redated, and it looks to be like the fossil is probably going to be quite a bit older than 18,000 years old. And so I think everyone has kind of waited with bated breath to see what the next set of dates are going to bring, to sort of see just how old or just how recent she really is. But even if her older date holds true, that's still fairly recent in the Pleistocene, and that still sort of offers these interesting ideas about how hominids are migrating, where their populations are going, all of these sorts of things. So I think that regardless of anything, I don't think any of her cachet is going to be diminished.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. John is on the line in Dallas. Hi, John.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Oh, well, my question was, that I've always kind of been mystified by, is why are dinosaurs, who were extinct 65 million years ago, but we have many complete skeletons of dinosaurs, but then as relatively recent as mankind is there, that we have such a limited fossil record in comparison to dinosaurs?
That's a really good question, actually. And I think it gets back to this idea that, there's a lot smaller of a distribution of hominids geographically. Sort of as we were talking about, we see them in Africa, in Asia, Southeast Asia, in Europe, whereas we see dinosaurs globally. And so that just ups your odds of finding a fossil, looking at that kind of geographic distribution. There's also the idea that hominids are hard to find. They're a lot smaller, and so there it's harder to find those kind of fossils. And it also depends a lot on the geologic context that dinosaurs fossilize in versus other kinds of geologic contexts for the hominid fossils.
How have these specimens been sort of recreated for the general public over time, you know, made up into, say, wax figurines or something that might be displayed in a museum?
That was one of the most interesting and unexpected avenues that I ended up exploring in the book. I didn't think that I would be tracing these kind of museum exhibits, but once I started seeing the early reconstructions from the 20th century, early 20th century, especially from the Field Museum in Chicago, I really became interested in sort of how do museum displays evolve as well. As sort of our cultural understanding of these specimens. And so, the idea that we want to put a face on these fossils, I think, is very important. And we start to see that very early on in the museum studies, that as soon as we have this kind of fossil to go on display, or this kind of cast of a fossil to go on display, we immediately want to put a face with it. And that idea of putting the face, or putting a wax figurine, or putting some kind of reconstruction, I think it immediately creates this story or this narrative for us to think about with these ancestors, these fossil ancestors.
And of course, some of them have needed makeovers over the years. For example, the Neanderthals that used to look like cavemen now look, you know, people have said if you put one in a business suit on the commuter train next to you, you might not pick them out in the crowd.
I can't think of another species that has undergone such a transformation in its museum exhibits as Neanderthals. As you were saying, when you look at some of these early ones, it's very stooped. They're very hunched. They're very much this sort of knuckle-dragging caveman trope. But when you look at some of the newer reconstructions, ones like the ones by John Gersh, a paleo artist, who contributed a brilliant Neanderthal reconstruction to the Smithsonian Institute, there really is this sort of reimagining and sort of granting this fossil a lot more agency and culture and a better reflection of sort of where modern science is now.
You say that the human remains found initially by Lee Berger's school-age son are TBA in terms of their celebrity status.
Yes. And one of the things that I was interested in exploring with the book was looking at the seven different kinds of celebrities. So some of these fossils we've talked about, they're famous for different reasons. Sort of Peking Man is famous because it's missing, and the Piltdown is famous because it's a hoax, and we have the Tong Child as sort of this folk hero. And because the fossil that you mentioned, the one found by Berger's son, was found so recently in 2008 and published in 2010, I feel like the kind of celebrity that that history will find for it is still to be determined.
We've had Lee Berger on the show, and he was delightful, but he is certainly no stranger to the benefits of public relations. Do you think he will help to sort of raise the profile of his fossil?
I think so. And I think he definitely already has. And certainly the Institute of Evolutionary Studies at the University of Witwatersrand definitely does. When I had the chance to go to the Institute and to interview him and to talk to other researchers there, it was great to walk into the hall and to see these prints, these huge prints of Sidiba on the cover of Science magazine. And the fact that it has been on the cover, this one fossil has been on the cover three times, is unprecedented in the history of Science magazine. And it felt like walking by model headshots or something as you were going into the office. And so there was very much this sense that we want to celebrate this fossil and to also be able to use it to remind people about being excited about science.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Gerald is on the line in Lucas. Hi, Gerald.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I had my DNA checked by 23andMe, and they indicated that I have 2.5% Neanderthal DNA. Does that occur frequently, and does it go beyond even the Neanderthals?
I've got some too, Gerald, so full disclosure as we get our answer here from Lydia.
So I would preface this by saying that I am not a geneticist, and so I would definitely suggest checking out some of the awesome work by Svante Paabo, who is a brilliant paleogeneticist, to really get at your question there. But certainly it's not uncommon. I hear lots and lots of stories from people finding various amounts of Neanderthal in them. And I think that right now Neanderthals are the only ones that people are being sort of checked with, checked against, what have you. And I think that that's just because other sequencing hasn't happened for other species.
I can't really tell you why this is the case, but I really like thinking about a time when there might have been multiple human species wandering around, interacting, maybe treating each other with some fear or disdain. It's just interesting to think about.
It creates this entire really interesting drama, I think, of the Pleistocene, that as a geologic epoch, there isn't a time in sort of hominid history that we have more species running around the planet than we do in the Pleistocene. And as you say, I think that that's a really compelling narrative to think about.
Yeah, you wonder, were our ancestors wishing all those other guys would go away and then they got their wish? And, you know, how different would the world be if there were still multiple human species?
So one of the science fiction books I ended up looking at actually imagines the future with Neanderthals sort of having a successful evolution out of the Pleistocene. It's a science fiction trilogy by Robert Sawyer. And I thought that it was really fun that he would explore that very question that you're asking. What if there's another species out of the Pleistocene?
So do you think that there are more surprises on the horizon?
I think absolutely there are. And I think that fossils like Flo and fossils like Sediba definitely point to the idea that there are new discoveries and new things that are happening. And it was funny to be writing this book and to see so many fossil discoveries that were making the headlines and making the media, even sort of as I was writing this, that there were other new species that were coming out.
It's also occurred to me that there may have been, you know, non-professionals who stumble upon fossilized human remains, and unless there's an obvious skull there, walk right by.
I'm sure. I'm sure that's true.
Yeah. The other thing that is fascinating to me is that there are scientists who study this stuff for their entire careers who realistically know that they will never make this discovery. They might work with something important. Is that something that bothers them?
I think that at the beginning of the 20th century and the middle of the 20th century, there's this really important, there's the sense that finding a big fossil is really important. And it's very discovery based, very sort of, we need a thing there to be excited about. And I think that at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, I think that people have sort of stepped on the brakes a little bit and sort of wanted to understand more about behavior and culture and sort of look to broader questions rather than just trying to find the next big thing.
So they're maybe not tempted to do a fraud or they're not
right,
no more
piltdown.
Right,
exactly. Exactly. That I think that in some ways there are enough really big, exciting science questions that are behind these kind of fossils now that I think that the focus has changed quite a bit.
Lydia Pine's new book is called Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. Lydia, it's been really interesting. Thanks for making time for us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones from Emily Goldstein, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Our Twitter handle is at KERAThink. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.